Did you know that you can be a critically thinking, rational person and be a Christian? Did you know that there's good evidence that Christianity is true? Did you know that the Christian faith can withstand the toughest of scrutiny? Welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast, where we believe because of the brains God gave us and not in spite of them. I'm your host, Evan Minton. Welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast, where we use the brains that God gave us. Today, I have on the podcast John Wise. John Wise is a philosophy professor, and he runs the podcast The Christian Atheist. And he has made the first several of the transcripts of his podcast episodes into a book, which is called Through the Looking Glass, The Imploding of an Atheist Professor's Worldview. And I will leave a link to that book in the episode description below. Hello, Professor Wise. It is good to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Evan. It is a delight to finally meet you after corresponding back and forth a little bit. And I'm looking forward to our discussion today.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is the Christian atheist, and what does that term even mean? Some might say that it sounds contradictory, like the term married bachelor or one-ended stick.
Yes, indeed. Well, I am a philosophy professor, as you said at the beginning of the podcast. I teach currently for the University of Arizona Global Campus. But I did my PhD at the University of California, Irvine, and received it in 2004. And so I taught from 2004 at the university, excuse me, it was about 2007 when I started teaching at the University of, East Stroudsburg University of Pennsylvania. And I taught there for about 7-8 years as an atheist. I originally started my life as a Christian. So I grew up in a Christian home, went to Bible college to become a pastor. And by the time I graduated from Bible college, I had begun to question my faith very seriously. And soon after, when I began my PhD program at the University of California, Irvine, I was walking across campus one day and I just said, "There is no God." And from that point forward, I no longer believed in God. And I taught as a philosophy professor who was not hostile to theism, but did not myself believe. And so for many, many years, I taught philosophy as an atheist professor. But in 2019, after a series of events and a long path, I came back to my faith in Christ. And so the term Christian atheist was something that evolved in my own mind, my own thinking, because having turned the corner, I was a Christian now, but I had still in the back of my mind the capability to think like an atheist thinks. And I think that gives me an edge up in relating to the non-believing world, because I understand where the atheist is coming from better than Christians who have grown up in Christianity their whole life. And of course, I had that too, because early in my life, I was a Christian and then walked away. And when I came back, I now had two mindsets to work from. And so the Christian atheist evolved from that. Although I actually took the term from a YouTube video that I saw Jordan Peterson talking about the notion of a lot of the people, he said, coming to his biblical series would say to him that they are kind of like Christian atheists. That is, they're atheists. They don't believe in God, but they believe in the fundamentals underlying the Christian worldview. And of course, there's a bit of a contradiction in that, but that was kind of where I stood around the time I became exposed to Jordan Peterson. And so I thought to myself, why don't I start a podcast or do something that relates to that and try to bring this reasoning process to the world? And it never panned out. But when I married my wife in 2019, she said, hey, let's do it. And so I said, okay, I've got a name for it. And that name became The Christian Atheist.
Nice.
So yeah, a bit of a contradiction. I understand that. I tend to think of it, though, not as a contradiction, but as a paradox. Because like Jesus, it seems that there's a contradiction between God being man and man being God. And yet the incarnation is not a contradiction because it's a fact. It's a reality. And therefore, it's a paradox, something that's hard to believe, but that's still true.
So basically, it's like you're a Christian, but you have that sort of rational, hard, give me the evidence, I just want to know what's true, kind of mindset, not just believing on blind faith or emotional experiences like a lot of Christians.
Yeah, that's a good way to characterize it.
Yeah, I can kind of relate to that, although I've never been an atheist myself. I have gone through major spells of doubt. I grew up in the church, and I did come to make the faith my own through the experiential process. But when I went out to go share my faith, I was bombarded with all of these questions and counter arguments against Christianity. And I almost became an agnostic at 18. I'd say I'd had like three major spells of doubt. And that's what led me to look into apologetics and, you know, is it really true? Are there really good reasons to believe? And so I think, like yourself, I think God has kind of used that, because I can kind of relate to like both kinds of Christians. I can relate to people like you, because I also want reasons and I want arguments and evidence. I want to sift fact from fiction and hold to what is true.
Exactly.
But at the same time, I also understand Christians who have come to the faith because a friend invited them to church and they had a radical experience with God as well. And that experience felt very real. And because I believe there is a God who exists, I believe a lot of these encounters are veridical.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Actually, there's a passage in one of C.S. Lewis's essays where he talks about the fact that the vast majority of Christians, as well as the vast majority of atheists, are people that have never really thought clearly or deeply about what it is they believe. They're just going along with the crowd. And he said, among them, there are probably a lot better Christians than me and a lot better atheists than I was an atheist when I was. So, and I think he's probably right about that. I think there is, as Jesus said, a great power in coming to God as a child. And at one level, of course, we all have to do that. But there's another level in which, for me, the faith had to become not the faith of my parents, but the faith of myself. And that was a long process back from where I left.
In the preface of your book, you say that the book chapters are transcripts of your podcast, which is what I said in the introduction to this episode. What made you want to turn your podcast episodes into a book? Why not just keep them as podcast episodes?
Yeah, that was my original impulse. But I had several listeners message me and say, this is really dense material. It would be useful if I could read it and therefore digest it at my own speed and be able to look back and forth between the episodes. And they said, could you put this into a book? And I thought, yeah, I don't think so at first. But as I got more requests for that, I thought, okay, we'll give it a shot. And then my wife, Jenny, being the brilliant person she is, she figured how to self-publish it on Amazon. And we said, we'll give it a shot, see what happens. And then I've gotten some really good feedback that it's helpful in that form. So hopefully God can use that too. Multiple formats, hopefully we'll be able to get the message out there. And since it is such dense material, I guess I can see the value in having it in a more concrete form.
Yeah. Sometimes it is easier to actually see what the information than to hear it. And with my learning skills, sometimes it's easy it's easy to get both. Like when I read William Lane Craig's and J.P. Moreland's Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview, sometimes I tried to like go back and forth between like reading and listening because I had the audiobook, but it was so dense. I'm like, no, I've just got to stick to reading. I used the whispers. I read and listened at the same time because I used the Whisper Sync material, the thing that Amazon has between their ebook and their Audible. Mm-hmm. In chapter one, you said, and here I don't know if I have recorded the quote in my notes correctly, but let's see, I meant to have. What chapter was that?
In chapter one, faith, not knowledge. I had a hard time finding it myself. I had to look through my transcripts and then do a find search for it to find the passage. You want me to read it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I can't find it.
No problem. In chapter one, you said faith, not knowledge, is the proper epistemic attitude toward the transcendent. As transcendent. As unknowable, we must approach him, that is God, as an asymptotic ideal, with an openness to correction, to admiration, to worship as our highest aspiration, but with fear and trembling, lest we presume too much.
Yeah, the problem was as I was making these notes with my phone, and autocorrect has took over as I was making the transcription.
I thought so that might be the case.
It changed aspiration to desperation, and for some reason it put open nester. But anyway, I was going to ask about this this passage. Could you explain in more detail what you meant by that?
Yeah. If we understand the history of the Christian faith and we understand what logic leads us to as we reason about things, I think one of the fundamental things that we need to understand as Christians and as non-Christians, if we're going to find our way to God, is that faith is primary. It's not secondary. Faith is where we start, and that every human being starts in faith. Because we are fundamentally ignorant creatures. And this is the basic lesson of Socrates. Right? Socrates said, the one thing that I know is that I do not know anything. And that was the fundamental place that, in many ways, Western philosophy took its start. What we have to recognize as human beings is that we are limited in time and space, and therefore limited in our capacity to know things. And when we approach something that is infinite, we're going to be inadequate to understand it. And everything in human experience, and I'm anticipating a lot of where we may go here, everything in human experience is founded on things that are transcendent, such as the term infinity in mathematics. You can't encounter, by its very nature, what infinity is, because infinity is beyond the finite, and we are finite creatures. God is, as he says in the Bible, so far above us as the heavens are above the earth, right? We don't understand God. We cannot understand God. We can get glimpses, but those glimpses simply point us beyond the realities we can see and feel and touch to something that grounds them ultimately. So in some ways, I mean, we talk about, you refer to the cosmological argument a little later, I think, in the questions that you sent me. But there, that notion that there is a causality that is basic to human reason always points us beyond what we can grasp towards that which we cannot grasp. And that which we cannot grasp actually grounds what we can. Because on what basis would we look around and say that this world can exist unless we understand something that is bigger, that is actually causing it to exist? So there's the cosmological argument in in a nutshell, but I think I'm saying more than that. Let me see if there's another passage here. Oh, the asymptotic ideal is kind of what I'm expressing there. In mathematics, right, we approach the asymptote, which is off the graph. So we have a little line that is approaching it, but no matter how far out you go to infinity, it never actually touches the reality that it's moving towards. And God is kind of like that. We can grow in our knowledge of him, our understanding of him, but he's always going to be transcendent beyond us. And therefore, at the end of the quote, I say, when we approach God and we talk about God, we had better do it in fear and trembling, because if we think we've got it sewn up, we're in deep trouble. And I think that's a warning to the church and to the unbelieving.
Yeah, I guess the way I would characterize it is that you can know God exists, you can know Christianity is true, and you can understand a lot about God and a lot about the Bible if you just do enough rigorous study, homework, reflection. But there will always be mysteries, because he, like you said, he is an infinite being. And for me, faith is, it's trust in a being. Like, I trust in God, I trust in Jesus. And like I say at the end of my Gospel Reliability series, like, there's no amount of apologetic arguments is ever going to help when, like, I don't know where my next meal is coming from, or when I don't know what tomorrow may bring, when the future is uncertain. I just have to trust that, you know, God said, I'm going to take care of you. And I just have to believe that. Some examples of things that, like, I can't grasp a hold of are things like, how does God know the future? And there's a lot of debate and a lot of speculation within philosophy of religion there. I hold to a view called Molinism. I've talked a lot about that on this podcast. One of the objections against Molinism is the grounding objection. How does God know counterfactuals of creaturely freedom? That objection doesn't really bother me, because it's like asking, how can God create out of nothing? Well, I don't know, but I've got good reasons, both biblically and scientifically, to believe that he did.
Mm-hmm. And rationally.
Yeah, and what is it like to be three persons? Well, I don't know, because I'm only one person.
Yep. But one of the great things about that is that God gives us all of these sort of analogical things around us that help us to grasp those larger concepts that we can't grasp, like marriage. And I don't know if you're a married man, but my marriage to my wife has taught me more about God and a relationship with him and the nature of the Trinity than I ever got by studying the theology texts.
I'm not married, but I hope to be one day. I recently heard my friend Nick Peters of Deeper Waters. He said that his cat reminds him of his relationship with God, because he is this superior being, and yes, a cat, it's like, well, we don't know what it's like to be a cat, but a cat could scarcely comprehend the thoughts of us intelligent human beings. Mm-hmm. And they are 100% dependent on us. Yeah. If I don't bring home cat food, the jelly bean back here is going to starve.
Yeah, actually, C.S. Lewis uses that example, too, in different places. He talks about the dog and how the human being has raised the dog to a new level by domesticating it and feeding it and taking care of it and washing and cleaning it so that it doesn't stink. It's like God has to deal with us limited creatures that are imperfect and still try to raise us to the level of an acceptable being that he can be in the presence of. And of course, the ultimate way to do that is through the sacrifice of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. So what is your take on Christianity and science? That is something that comes up a lot between Christians and atheists. And I often think that both sides get a lot of things wrong and just muddy the waters beyond what they need to be. Mm-hmm. When it comes to Christianity and science, there's basically three broad camps, and I know there's a lot of nuance in each of these camps, but broadly they are young earth creationism, old earth creationism, which is sort of the earth is billions of years old, so is the universe, but evolution didn't take place. And then there's a view that is called theistic evolution. Which would you describe yourself, which one of those camps would you fall into, and why do you hold to that position?
To a certain extent, I'm a bit of an agnostic on the problem, because I mean, if we're just talking about those three options, it's like, I don't know how God did it. It seems to me that the scientific evidence is revealing to us a world that is very old. Humankind came into existence at some point, and the Genesis narrative presents to us a human being, Adam, a first human being. How exactly that first human being God brought into existence, created, and I do consider myself a creationist at the deepest level, God created that human being. Did he create it through a process of evolution? I don't know. I'm not sure. And I'm not going to nail myself down in a way that closes off other ways of knowing and understanding. And so I try to be open to all of the evidence that's presented to me, scientific and empirical, and try to make sense of it. But at one level, I don't need to make sense of it because God did it, no matter how you look at it. And that, for me, is the fundamental faith that underlies everything. You talked just a little while ago about faith. And the one element that I think that is often missing in the secular worldview is that faith is fundamentally a choice. Now, you can say, oh no, faith is compelled. Well, if it's compelled, then it's knowledge. But faith is actually standing on something that's not certain and saying, this is what I think is right. I'm going to see where it takes me. That's what the scientific process is. It's taking a faith position, saying, hey, I think this explains it pretty well. Let's test it, see how it works. And the better it works, the more we prove its truth, the more sure we become of the foundation. But again, it's that asymptotic ideal. We don't get there. We don't get to knowledge on it. We get to the point of saying, hey, this has worked continuously. It seems to be the best answer. And that, for me, is theism. It is the best answer out there. And of course, theism collapses into Christianity for me, but there's no better answer. The reason behind Christianity provides the most comprehensive, rational view of the world that explains the facts. And in a lot of ways, I almost feel bad for atheists when they have to argue against the theistic worldview, because the preponderance of the rationality isn't on their side. And they end up actually assuming an awful lot of the things that are found in theism. I mean, you can't do science without assuming a vast amount of overlap with the theistic worldview. You have to believe that there's an actual reality out there to discover, and that that reality should correct our thinking about it. And that reality is God, in whom we live, move, and have our being.
Yeah, it reminds me of what you said there at the end. It reminds me of the C.S. Lewis quote that I'm very fond of. He said, men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver.
Yeah, I think that's dead on.
For me, I've studied this issue for several years. I would come down on the theistic evolution side. I do think that the evidence more strongly supports common ancestry. I'm somewhat agnostic on the origin of life question, though I'm very sympathetic to the Intelligent Design Discovery Institute position on that. But like you said, in a way, for me, this is just like out of curiosity. It's just, I want to know, hey, how did God do it? Mm-hmm. I believe that God did it, but... So oftentimes when non-evolutionist Christian brothers will press me on, hey, why do you what they like would try to debate the evolution evidence with me, and I'm like, I'm not really too interested in that. And yeah. I'll tell them, you know, I'm an apologist for Jesus. I'm not an apologist for Darwin. If you want to look at, and I'll give them some resources. I'm like, if you want to look at some arguments for evolution, look at some of these, and here's some good places to look at arguments against evolution.
Yeah.
Like, I only care at the level of moderate curiosity.
Yeah. Well, C.S. Lewis has an article or an essay called The Funeral of a Great Myth, in which he addresses the issue of evolution. And he explicitly bifurcates the question. He says, look, there is a biological theory of evolution, but that's independent of the idea of evolution that has pervaded our culture. And I don't know how far you've gotten into my podcast, but one of the evil characters in my podcast, the person that I am claiming, as I argue throughout the rest of the seasons, we just put out number 104 today, love. Yeah. Our 104th episode was published today. But throughout the Christian atheist, one of the people I argue is responsible for the dethroning of God in our secular culture is the philosopher Hegel. And Hegel really, in a lot of ways, instantiated the notion of an evolutionary mindset. And I think Hegel profoundly influenced Darwin. But whether or not Darwin is right about the question of evolution is an independent question. There is a pernicious influence in believing the idea that things are getting better all the time. And that's not equivalent to Darwin's theory, not his biological theory. But we in today's culture, today's world, have this idea that the world is evolving in the sense of getting better all the time. It's what the woke culture is based on. It's what the Marxist culture is based on. And all of them go back and find their origins in the philosophy of Hegel. That's my spiel.
So I want to ask you something. I meant to have put it in my notes, but the thing you said about if it's compelled, it's knowledge and not faith. What do you mean by compelled? Where do you fall on like the voluntarism debate?
Okay. When you start actually using the technical language for this, I've been out of that debate for 25 years. And so I'm only slowly coming back, and I don't know the languages. I don't know the terminology, and I don't know the people involved in things over the last few years. So I'm not sure what voluntarism means.
That's the view that you can choose what you believe, and there's direct docetic voluntarism, which is I don't hold to this, and I really don't know anybody who does, but the term exists. So I'm sure there are some people who hold it. It's that you can just up and choose to believe anything at any moment just through your own volition. And then there's indirect docetic voluntarism, which is you can choose what you believe through a series of choices. So, like, you can choose whether or not you're going to listen to both sides of the argument. You're going to choose how much reading you're going to do on a different topic.
Yes.
You're going to choose whether or not you can, whether or not you're going to think about it at all, or just kind of put it out of your mind. And in that sense, you are responsible for what you believe, because you have made these prior series of choices which led up to you drawing your current conclusion.
Okay. So actually, we're going to get to this when we talk about Jean-Paul Sartre. And I have my own views on all of that. I think there is a series of choices we make that lead to our higher level beliefs. But what I mean by compulsion is, in many ways, the phenomenological view. And I studied phenomenology quite seriously in graduate school. So when I'm sitting here and I look over there, I see my wife sitting there. And at one level, that is a compelled belief. So I know that my wife is sitting across from me. I can feel her feet under the table touching mine. I know that she's there. So that's kind of a compelled knowledge. And yet that compelled knowledge can be doubted at the higher level, what I would call the metaphysical level. I can go there and say, yes, but I could be dreaming. I could tell a rational story that would explain away what I consider knowledge to be. So knowledge can be doubted, but at some level it is compelled to. And I think belief, as in Christian belief, and I have arguments back and forth with atheists in this all the time, is the only word we have. You can call it belief, you can call it faith, but every human being engages in faith, that is accepting what is given to them at some level, and that they're believing it, they're accepting it. Faith comes in when you start to explain it in a different way. When you say, for instance, all of this is grounded in a higher being that I call God, there is a faith element to that. And you can choose not to agree with that faith element and then be an atheist. You can deny it or you can accept it. But in either case, you're making a choice about that postulate, because reason is different from direct experience. And the two work together, as Kant tells us, to produce belief or knowledge. You can't, if you're going to have knowledge, you have to have both combining at the same time.
So would you say that maybe like some knowledge is foisted upon us, but others can be like, we can choose whether or not we come to know it through like opening up a textbook or, you know, opening up Google. If it's something as simple as what are the symptoms of this type of disease, let me go on WebMD and, you know.
Yeah. Well, Sartre actually talks about this at the level of ontology, what he calls ontology. And I think what you're talking about is something that is compelled, right? I may very well be able at the metaphysical level to explain away my wife's existence over there and say, I'm just imagining it. But I can't deny that I'm experiencing, that I'm seeing my wife over there. That is compelled. It's part of the very essence of what it is to be a human being. You are experiencing something, and that something is a compelled knowledge. Now, you can, as I say, doubt that, but you can only doubt it at the higher level when you try to explain it in a different way.
Interesting. I remember this takes me back to an earlier episode of the podcast, which I had David Paulman on. He's really interested in ontology, and we were talking about whether or not belief in God is properly basic. What does the term properly basic even mean? And he was thinking, well, his definition was properly basic beliefs are incorrigible beliefs. Yes. It's incorrigible that you are having an experience of, I'm having an experience of this laptop, but it's not incorrigible that, you know, maybe I'm a brain in a vat, you know, the whole, mm-hmm. you know, or a victim of Descartes' demon.
That's precisely my point. Yep. You nailed it.
So when you became an atheist, was it due to simply not knowing the wealth of apologetic arguments out there, or did you know about, say, the cosmological argument, the fine-tuning argument, arguments for the trustworthiness of the Gospels, etc., but still reject Christianity in spite of it? Yes. In most cases that I know of, it is the former. It's that they just didn't know about these arguments, like Lee Strobel, for example. And then he started to investigate it and was like, wow, there's actually some pretty good reasons to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe that the arguments for God's existence, including the evidence that we have for scripture and all the rest of the things, can be incredibly powerful as an aid to faith. But at some level, there is a faith that precedes them. There is a stepping out that says, hey, this is at least possible that this is the correct answer. Let me see when I look at the evidence, whether or not that's going to work. So there is a fundamental faith, I think, underlying, and by fundamental faith, I mean a choice that's underlying that step. And I don't think, and having been an atheist, I'm pretty sure it's true, that any amount of evidence or reason will convince an atheist that will convince an atheist in the sense of compel an atheist to believe in God. It's like Jesus said to was it Lazarus? Lazarus when he was in right, and Lazarus, that's right, to the rich man and Lazarus, where he said, could you send someone back, the rich man who's suffering in hell, could you send someone back to let the people know that that this is real, or something like that. I forget the exact quote. And Jesus said, even if someone would raise from the dead, they have Moses and the prophets. If they don't believe them, they won't even believe that sort of miracle. And I think that's absolute truth, because as an atheist, for me, it was not a matter of knowing or not knowing the arguments. And they were easy enough to reject because I chose to reject them.
The way I see it is, like, it is obviously going to be a lot easier to persuade through the use of these arguments if a person is open and willing to, you know, look at both sides and you know, follow the evidence where it leads. Right. But with those who are sort of like willfully resistant, I think it can still be helpful because it's making it harder to disbelieve. You can still do it, but you have to kind of work at it. And I like the way the popular apologist Greg Kokel puts it. He says, I'm putting a rock in their shoe.
That's pretty good. Yeah, I like that.
So, and so that's basically, and there's this there's this agnostic turned deist that I've been you know, arguing with on lots of different topics for like 5 years. I don't know if he'll ever become a Christian, but I've put basically an entire quarry in his shoes. I hope so.
Good for you. It can be an uphill battle, I know, because boy, when you argue with them, it goes round and round in circles, and you can't get them to concede the most basic facts. It's maddening.
Yes. Even getting them to concede like just a little bit, like with the resurrection, for example, like, will you at least concede that the tomb was empty, even if you want to explain it in some other way? No, mm-hmm. I'm going to reject all your arguments for the empty tomb.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, a species of that is the fairly new, I mean, I hadn't encountered this much before, but the people who are actually even denying the historicity of the person Jesus, the man Jesus. It's like, how can you in any rationally grounded way reject the history of the man? Because I mean, all of history points back there. It's so ridiculous. And yet there's a growing movement of people who are doing exactly that. It's maddening.
Yeah, I mean, the way I like to tell these they're called Christ mythers or Jesus mythicists. It's like, you basically have to say that the entire first century, Christian and non-Christian alike, all somehow independently made up the same person and acted as though he were a real person.
It is astounding. And they call us, you know, fantasists, that we're making up our reality. Boy, I guess in today's world, it's even worse. We look around us and we see people who are believing they can turn their gender from one to another. So, I mean, I guess we can live in a fantasy world if we choose.
Yeah. So how did Immanuel Kant influence your faith journey?
Kant was in many ways the sort of foundation and the cornerstone of my turn back, because Kant convinced me pretty much single-handedly, although it was reinforced very strongly by Jean-Paul Sartre, that faith is not, as I said, a matter of, you know, believing one thing and knowing other things. Faith is, as Augustine and Anselm told us, faith is the foundation of all of human life. I believe in order that I may understand. If we don't have belief at the most basic level, we can't move forward in the world, because we've got to trust something in order to move forward, in order to decide, in order to act in the world. And Kant made that case for me in such a way that I could not avoid it as an atheist. And so I began to believe that faith was the starting place for everything. And when you allow that crack in your atheist view, that you are simply holding on to certain knowledge, and that's the only thing you'll accept, when you allow that faith to become a crack in your worldview, everything slowly starts to crumble and come apart. So that was kind of like the starting point.
In your book, you have a section called Five Lessons from Jean-Paul Sartre. What are those five lessons?
Okay, so I tried to encapsulate these a little bit more succinctly than I did in the episodes and in the podcast. So as we talked about Kant earlier, belief, that is axiomatic belief, what we believe as the basis on which we move forward, precedes our seeking for understanding. So any rational account, that is a metaphysical account, a way to explain to ourselves reality, is metaphysics. And it is based on some sort of faith position. So essentially, again, what we're finding here in Sartre is that Sartre is reasserting the point that Kant made, that faith is where we have to go when we start explaining things. It's different from that level of phenomenological certainty where we can't explain away our experience. So that's the first lesson. And second, while we can know our experience, those phenomenological givens, as certain, because they are our direct experience, they cannot be denied. We are experiencing that. When we seek to explain it metaphysically, we're making a choice. We can say, for instance, all of this reality that I find around me must rationally be caused by something, because causality is one of those rational elements that is inherent in our human nature. It is one of those phenomenological givens. When human beings see something, they seek for the cause of that thing. It's very fundamental to who we are. It's a phenomenological given. It's part of our knowledge. Without it, we have no rationality whatsoever. So we choose a way to explain things. That is faith in God, or the denial of that faith in God. Okay, so we haven't actually got to the point of God here. What I'm making the point there in the second point is that faith is a choice, not an unconstrained choice, right? We can't choose to believe anything we want to. We have to have reason to believe. We have to have evidence to believe. But at some point, we choose a rational explanation of what it is we're experiencing. The third point, God, Sartre argues, is one of the ideals that exists as a phenomenological given in our experience. That is, not necessarily that we call him God. That is a later sort of accretion, something that we put onto it. But we have inherent in our human rationality the idea of a being that is self-caused. So there's your cosmological argument, the teleological argument, those things like that. Sartre actually says, and I think he makes a pretty darn good case for it, that that is one of the fundamental realities in our experience. So that's the third point. Fourth, while Sartre himself was an atheist to the end of his days, one of the most famous atheists in the 20th century, Sartre understood that atheism was faith. And you want to talk about a crack in the dam of atheism. that was, along with Kant, and you can see how it's actually dependent upon Kant, that was the moment when I was doing my dissertation research, when I came across a quote by Sartre that he clearly said, atheism is faith. Suddenly, everything that I was holding on to in my atheist worldview started to wash away. Because if it's faith, then how is it different from what the Christians are believing? And then I said, okay, well, then what I've got before me are two rational ways of looking at the world, the Christian view, the theistic view, and the atheistic view. And now I have to evaluate them on the basis of which one makes the most sense. So that was the fourth point. The fifth point was a little bit more tangential from Sartre than the other four. In the world in which we try to explain everything through our rational structures, those rational structures can be constrained by the experience, by the givens, by the evidence, by the empirical things, by the rationality, or they can be unconstrained. That is, they can wander off into a fantasy land. And we can choose to accept either one. And I think atheism, and certainly the world in which we live today, has gone much farther over to the fantasy land, whereas Christianity has maintained the rational structures. And it became a choice between, you know, believing that science is real, that what I see around me is grounded, that I can believe my senses, that I can believe the structures that Western civilization, by believing in the Christian worldview, managed to build this world, this amazing world that we live in, that is so different from anything the vast majority of humanity, stretching back however far humanity goes, has ever lived in. I'm not sure why I'm buzzing. Oh, it's my sugar. Sorry, my wife asked me a question there. It's high. So Sartre's point on that one was, if you are believing that your atheism is not faith, then you're acting in bad faith because you're not being truthful to yourself. So hopefully that does a good job of explaining the 5 points I drew from Sartre.
Yep. And for listeners, like, you can pick up his book if it is, you know, a little dense to listen to through audio only. I will again just want to remind you, I will put a link to the book in the episode description below, and you will be able to pick that up and read it. It's available in paperback and Kindle, I think.
Paperback, it's audio, yeah, not audio. Paperback, digital and soft cover, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And yeah, and technically it is also available in audio because it's, you know, the podcast.
Right, that's true too. And it's free on the podcast.
Yes. So, how did Jordan Peterson aid in your journey? Now, Jordan Peterson, I think a lot of my listeners are going to know him by now. A lot of people love him or hate him. Jordan Peterson is pretty well known. And in your book, you explain how he furthered your journey that some of these other philosophers sort of pushed you along, and Jordan Peterson just pushed you even further.
Right. Well, Jordan Peterson came at just the right time because he had a series on the Bible. And of course, I read his book, 12 Rules for Life, which essentially reinforces the entirety of the Christian worldview from a secular position. So it's amazing to see that Jordan Peterson, and he and I started in academia about the same time, and we went very different paths, right? He was a psychologist and I was a philosopher. And yet at the end of our journeys, if you call this the end now, we've come to essentially the same conclusions. It's interesting to hear him talking now about the things. Through different paths, God brought us to the same places. I have no idea whether Jordan Peterson is a believer or not. He's made some indications that maybe he's moved in that direction. Don't know. But his work came at just the right time to show me that the Bible that I put away all those years ago when I became an atheist had a lot more to say to me than I was willing to give credence as an atheist. And so he intrigued me back into the book. And that is an inestimable advantage, right? If you're going to find Christ, you're going to find God again. The best, one of the best places to find it is in his book. And so Jordan Peterson helped me back into that. But I have to say, as important as all of these things were, the final catalyst that brought them all together was my wife. Meeting my wife, interacting with my wife while our spouses were dying, and recognizing through God's leading that there is a real world that can be a real transcendent world that can be to some degree instantiated or incarnated in this world. Because Jenny became my sort of
Alexa, ideal. Alexa, stop.
Alexa.
Yeah, there is a, there's an ongoing joke that, you know, that the Echo Dot wants to be my co-host. it doesn't matter. She is going to interrupt at some point.
Mine too. So anyway, my wife was, I think, the right, you say, talk about Jordan Peterson being the right person at the right time, but Jordan Peterson would not have been adequate. I needed something that pointed me to a transcendent value for me. And that became my wife. And she was really, I mean, we talk about this series being called Through the Looking Glass. And Jenny was my looking glass. She was the one that more than anything else brought all of what God had taught me over those 25 years to a head.
So what was it about your wife that really drove it home?
I think for me, from the time I turned to atheism, the world became, and G.K. Chesterton talks about the mystery, and you mentioned that earlier in the podcast too. The fundamental mystery of the world is something that I think is an incorrigible reality, right? It's something that we hold on to. It's something that we experience. Well, through my atheism, following the logic of the atheism, life became a series of demythologizing events, of destroying the mystery, of taking away the transcendent reality beyond the reality of this world, of, in a sense, immanentizing this world, making everything just present here. So I stopped believing in the ideal, right? And Jenny, in a sense, became, because she really became for me, an ideal, an instantiated reality of a more perfect reality, which is just a shadow of the incarnation, the most perfect reality becoming human, becoming real in the empirical world. And so I think at that level, that was what the most important purpose she served. Beyond the fact that as a looking glass, as a mirror, right, she reflected me back on myself. She made me look more carefully at myself and realize and understand I had been lying to myself for the last 25 years.
So are there any books that you plan on writing in the future? Do you plan on like making more podcast content into books, or is this pretty much it?
No, I do. In fact, we are working on one right now. We just did a series, a long series, on John Milton's Paradise Lost. And it was so rich, so powerful for us. And it seemed as though many of our listeners found it so as well, that we thought, well, it's probably worth turning this into a book that might be useful for people to study in churches, you know, whatever, for whatever purposes that would be God's voice being able to speak to them. So I think I'm currently working on doing that, not as quickly as I should be, if you ask my wife.
Before we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to plug? Like, do you have, besides the podcast, the Christian Atheist, which, by the way, listeners can get on Spotify. That's where I listened to it. Do you have like a blog or a YouTube channel or anything like that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, we have a YouTube channel. The easiest way, I think, to access it is to just put into the search on YouTube, The Christian Atheist with Dr. John Wise. And then you will get like pages and pages of material, including my interviews with Tom Jump, the atheist Tom Jump, with Michael Wiseman of The Bible Says What, and a bunch of other interviews as well, plus all of our content. And if you click on the picture of Jenny and I with the Christian Atheist beside it, it'll take you right to our webpage, where all of the content is very well ordered and structured, which Jenny does weekly. She spends a lot of time keeping things organized.
Very nice.
So that's the YouTube channel. Yeah. if you have just a few more seconds, I also have another podcast called Simple Gifts, which is also available, like The Christian Atheist, on all podcast platforms. Just look for Simple Gifts with Dr. John Wise. And it is designed to acquaint Christians and non-Christians with the classics of the Western world. And so I read them. At 5 days a week, we post something there. And it's designed to acquaint the world with so much of the lost knowledge that has allowed us to slide so far away from the reality of God in Christ. And it's designed to do that, although it's not nominally Christian. I read it without commentary. But I think all of those works importantly point people, Christians and non-Christians, to the Savior. And so that one's a very important one for us. And if those of you who find our content difficult, Jenny and I launched a subsidiary podcast on The Christian Atheist called No Compromise. We just published our 50th or 52nd, our 50th episode of that. And in that, Jenny and I talk back and forth, for instance, about the Mountie Ball curse tablet that was found in 2019. So we have a real wealth of content available to anybody who's interested.
Very, very nice. Well, thank you, Dr. Wise, for coming on to the Cerebral Faith Podcast. It was a pleasure having you.
It was a pleasure being here, Evan. Thank you. You're a delight to speak with.
Thank you.
And keep doing the great work. I think you're doing fantastic stuff.
Thank you. I want to give a shout out to my patrons, Danny Lozano, O.C. Jones, Andrew Melnick, Red Blade Flame, David Shannon, Marcy Schlafman, David Parrish, SlamRN, Nathan Hamilton, Brandon, and Brandon Whitaker. And if you would like to become a Cerebral Faith patron and support this ministry financially, go to patreon.com/cerebralfaith. Just for $3, you can get blog posts early. You can get episodes to the podcast episodes early. Depending on how much I make at a time, it could be it could be 5 days early. It could be 2 months early. But you will get it as soon as I get done making the podcast or the blog post or whatever. And you'll also get shout outs on the podcast like this one and some other cool gifts. So check it out. Peace out. God bless. And keep using the brains that God gave you.